pleasure to introduce today's collection. Spencer Shiva actually has an interesting story. He got his PhD from Stanford in 1999, and we attempted to recruit him to our department as a faculty member back then, but he chose to go and start from a company called Gigabeat. Online music company that was acquired by Napster, and I don't know what happened to Napster, but he went and joined Google, where he was working on a number of projects there, and now he's the director of the Kirkland Google site, which he just told me has over 200 employees, and also he's a distinguished entrepreneur at Google. So I'm sure.
Right. Thanks, Oren. It's great to be here. It's, I'm going to talk today about not about search, because I'm sure you've heard a number of talks on how Google does search. So today I'm going to talk about how we make money through the ad systems. And as it turns out, the complexities in building out the ad systems are actually pretty significant compared to even search, because the amount of data is going through the advertising system and the dynamic nature of the data is just pretty darn interesting in terms of computer science. So, in the beginning, you've seen this picture. This is what google.stanford.edu looked like. A whole bunch of machines, and Larry and Sergey had bought a bunch of hard drives from the back of a truck and built out these machines. And then we've been working on a number of other products. We've been working on collaborative applications, we've been working on email, instant messaging, large systems, and of course ads. Can you guys see this in the back? Cool. So what I'm going to talk today about is the core of the ad system. What are the key ways in which advertising works? And some of this may be obvious to many of you, but I suspect that the distinction between paper, impression, paper, call, paper, click, paper, whatever are pretty interesting concepts, and how they map into the billions of dollars that we make in Google are pretty interesting. Right. This is pay hyphen per hyphen something else. And I'm going to talk about the systems that are powering the ads backend in terms of how do we take this huge amount of data that we get and how dynamic they are and how do they get to work across multiple data centers and so on. Finally, I'll be talking about AdSense, which is one of the products I used to work on. It's a contextual targeted product where we want to show ads on the entire web that are contextually related to ads on a given to the given page. And also, please stop me at any point in time and ask me questions. I'll be happy to answer them. I get really bored if I just go through my slides. So do stop me. Early on, about maybe 5 years back, this is what Google Ads looked like. We introduced the pay-per-impression model. This is back in the late 1999, 2000 time frame, when pretty much everybody on the web was buying up eyeballs on and wanting to show advertisements on sites which had a lot of impressions. One of the key differences that Google had was this was targeted. So rather than showing a completely random ad, like click on the monkey ad on Google.com, which would have been a very bad experience for the user, we decided to hook it up to the actual keyword that the user was searching on. So in this case, the ad, the query is for rental. So we figured, why don't we start showing ads for rental as a keyword? And some of the most obvious ads were maybe rent.com in terms of searching the local apartments or searching for perhaps buying a condo in the Seattle area. So this is what we initially launched a few years back, and this is what is called a pay-per-impression model. So the advertiser comes and gives us money, say they buy a million impressions and give us, say, $2 for every 1,000 impressions that we show. A couple of key properties that this model had was that it had to be sold by Google's advertising tool. So we had a number of salespeople we used to call up, perhaps rent.com or Procter & Gamble and say, okay, we have a million impressions of Tide. that you want to sell, so how many of them do you want to buy? So there was a significant sales component to how we initially launched it. The other part of this was that for every keyword, there was an inventory management problem, because rental could be a very important keyword and would be required, would be desired by a number of different players. So inventory management was sort of an interesting problem. But it turned out this was too small in terms of it wasn't going to make us a few $1 billion and we were gone bankrupt, right? So that's kind of the problem. Then what we did was we started, this was the second part in our evolution, we started selling ads on a third position model. So here, what we said was, again, it's still on an impression basis, but rather than selling a single ad, we also had ad slots on the right-hand side of the page. So these were still relevant to what the user was looking for. And here, what we said was, the top spot is very well desired, so you had to pay $15 for that. But the second spot is $12, you still had to pay for that. And again, the model was on a pay-for-impression basis. And at this point, we moved from a purely our salespeople calling on people to a more of an online sales model, where we said any advertiser can come in and can buy these slots and pay the amount of money that we have to pay. So this was the next phase of our advertising product. Then came along AdWords, which is how we make a lot of money in Google right now. And this was a shift away from impressions to clicks. The model here is that if a user clicks on an ad, that's when the advertiser will end up paying Google for that particular ad slot. So this was sort of a pretty big shift back then. And so we had the idea of having the right-hand side slot as well as the top slot. And the first time, we actually introduced the notion of an auction mechanism, whereby the advertisers could bid whatever they wanted to bid, and we would decide which has to go in a pretty dynamic auction that runs all the time. And incidentally, by moving to the auction mechanism, we also simplified a whole bunch of problems around how do we manage inventory where you have a single sort of slot, and how do you not sell the inventory to folks that are at a non-fair price in either too much or too little. Does anyone know who made this code? You didn't know that. So, yeah. So, the key here is that we did not build a product that the market was asking for, because the market at that point was asking for the paper impression and paper slot kind of model. And the switch away from something that the market is asking for to something that seemed a little radical back then was turned out to be a good decision for us, but it's not obvious when the decision was made. So any questions before I get into some of the key concepts behind auctioning and advertising? All right, no. So, number of definitions. I'm going to keep using these definitions over the next few slides, so I want to make sure we understand these. Most of these things are pretty obvious. Paid inventory is the available slots on a per-page basis. So we have paid inventory at the top. There are maybe a couple of slots or maybe three slots or whatever the number of slots are, and then a number of slots on the site. And there's no fixed number of slots that you need to have, because if there isn't any competition for the slots, and clearly you would not have the spot. But in the case we do, we certainly have a maximum of as we have on a Google.com search result. Keywords are what people type in when they come to Google.com. Green pencils. They come in and type in green pencils, and they want to see information about green pencils as well as ads about green pencils. Impression is when we show an ad to a user. Even though we're not charging on a per impression basis, we certainly map it, as I'll show in a few slides, to how often do we show an ad to a user, and we count money that way. Creative is the actual ad. So in the banner ad world, it's like an image. It could be the click on the monthly banner ad. But in the context of textual ads, which is what we run on Google.com, these are a call to action saying, I want to buy green pencils here, or 10% off of green pencils. And there's a corresponding sort of call to action with multiple lines for creative and the keywords that actually are the required targeting criteria for that particular search query. CPM, unlike people, so CPM is cost of mil, which is actually 1,000 impressions. It's not cost of million. That's a common mistake a lot of people make. Anything that we do in terms of optimization beyond the assets, we usually look at what is the delta, how does the CPM change if we make a change to how we do targeting versus another way of doing the same target. CPC is cost per click. This is the amount of money that the advertisers are willing to pay on a per-click basis. It could be 30 cents, it could be $15, depending on how much the click is valued at by the advertiser. For example, a lawyer who wants to sue people for maybe a class action lawsuit on mesothelioma could be paying maybe $10. So there's a pretty wide range in terms of how much a click is valued by the advertiser. And we don't care about the actual prices. The prices are set by the advertiser. So the question is the CPM, is that the cost that it takes Google to generate an ad, or is it the amount of money that we make on 1,000 impressions? It's the latter. The cost per impression that we have is a pretty complicated function, because we had also served the Google.com ads and the Google.com search results, and there's a lot of crawling and indexing and search quality that goes into a lot of this. CPM over here, I mean that when you show an ad, how much money do we expect to make? The other way of thinking about this is RPM, which is the revenue per million. But CPM is the industry standard, so we use that. CTR is the click-through rate. How often on a given query would a person click on an ad, and that is the corresponding click-through rate? Here's an ad. So you can go to adverts.google.com, and you can sell whatever you want to sell. In this case, let's say you want to sell a Seattle penthouse, for example. And here there's a whole bunch of descriptions within that. It's a two-bed, two-bath, and a fantastic location, and it has a mountain. And what the advertiser wants to do in this case is to go and create a number of keywords. So the keywords that we have are Seattle apartment, Seattle condo, and here, the advertiser is going to put a dollar for every click that the person is going to get. So the advertiser has a model of how much these ads are worth to him, and so has figured out that I'm willing to pay a dollar on a per click basis. If you look at historically what has happened, he's gotten 125 clicks over 5,000 impressions. So 5,000 times this ad has been shown on Google.com, out of which 125 times this ad was clicked on. And to get to the average CPC, because this concept over here is the max CPC, this is the maximum amount of money advertisers are willing to pay. But this is, in fact, we end up charging the advertiser a lot less based on an auction that I'll talk about in a couple of slides. So this is what the advertiser does. They come in, they want to create, creatives for a variety of things that they want to sell. It could be your house, it could be your boat, it could be your hat. And they have a model of how much they want to spend on a per-click basis, and they bid on that, and they chose OneView.com. Question?
Do you attempt to define words by the semantic medium? Say, I want to buy the word window. Is there a way for people to tell if I search for window of opportunity versus a window covering, which window I'm in and when I purchased the
app? So the question is about how do we take into account the context of the given word? I'll actually talk about that in a subsequent slide, but at this point, think of this as a very simple concept. The advertiser has come in and said that I want to target on a window, and I want to show my ad for that. And there's some ambiguation that we can make recommendations on in terms of what are the different conditions of the given word. I actually want to show a demo towards the end of the talk. So the cost of creating an ad is very, very straightforward. And this is quite different than how it used to be, like, you know, a few years back, because you had the notion of agencies that would make ads for you, and they would have to worry about where the ads were going to be placed. And by making it all self-service, we made the advertising industry a lot easier to work with. So now let's talk about what goes on when an ad needs to be displayed on a Google.com search result. In a way, this is a specialized search. In the typical search case, what we do is we have many billions of documents that we have crawled from the web, and we want to, given a certain query, we would want to figure out the best sort of documents that you want to show to users. And this is done by Classic IR and a whole bunch of other signals that you must have heard about it in previous talks. We have the same kind of problem in here as well. Now, the reason why this is different is because the number of advertisers is much smaller. It's probably a few hundred thousand advertisers. But beyond that, the actual data is very dynamic, because they would like to change their grids, they would like to change their creative, the keywords on which they target. So it's a much more dynamic system, even though the data is much smaller. So in terms of complexity, this turns out to be a lot bigger. The other sort of point here is, when a query comes in, we need to figure out what is the utility of the ad to the different parties over here. There are three different parties playing here. One is the user. We want to make sure that the user's interest comes first, because if you start showing completely irrelevant ads to a person who comes to Google.com, then they'll be turned off. So we want to make sure that we give relevant ads to the given query. So that's one critical part of the equation. Second critical part is, we want to make sure that the advertiser can truly bid whatever they want to bid. How much ever is the value of a trick to them is what we need to model into how much they are willing to pay on a search result. And the third part of it is us. We want to make sure that we are making enough money as well, so we can power our Google.com search, our investor products that we keep developing. So we need to balance the high click-through rate of a given ad, because that implicitly tells us that the end user who is searching is interested in this particular ad, along with the advertiser's willingness to pay. So that's really what we need to model in terms of how we do the auction. So as it turns out, auction theory, which has been around for many, many years, is something we can tap into for deciding how do we show the best set of ads given query, as opposed to using information retrieval or the other ways of doing research. Here's a couple of examples. These are two different ads for the same query. Yeah.
So what happens if you get a search with no ads or very few ads actually related to that search query? Can you sort of expand? You said your concern with the relevance of the ads to the user's query. Do you have a broader scope of the ad search query at risk, bringing less money to ads, or you just...
So the question is, do we broaden the scope of our ads if there aren't enough ads for a given search query? There are a few variations that we do. For example, in the college admission, there are two different applications. One is on Google.com. Clearly, there are synonym-based expansions that you could do. Or perhaps in some other case, you can do sending to increase the scope of that. But in all these cases, what we do is we tell the advertiser, hey, here are some other keywords, and I'll have a demo of that later. And let the advertiser pick based on what they would like. In a number of cases, it turns out that the query hotel versus hotels end up having different behavior from the end user. We don't know why, but it does. And the second answer is, I'll be talking about AdSense, which is our contextual targeting product, where we have pages on the web rather than search queries. And in that case, we do a number of things to expand the scope of ads, because that's pretty much required for the problems we've been talking about. So a couple of ads. So let's say that skydiving is a concept that people want to advertise on. Two completely different markets. So one is a company that wants you to come and skydive with them. The other one is insurance, which also is a perfectly legitimate ad for that particular concept. So now the question is, which ad would you show? Because we have the top slots to fill up, or we have the right-hand side to fill up. And we want to make sure that these ads are relevant to what the user is actually trying to search on. Here are a couple of examples. The one case, the advertiser is willing to pay 40 cents, and here they're willing to pay 20 cents. And in this case, the CTR is 2%, and here the CTR is 5%. So now the question is, which ad would you want to show? So what we do is, this is where the CPM concepts come into play. We do effective CPM, which is just the expected amount of money you're going to make on that particular impression. And here, we have the effective CPM equal to $8, and here we have the expected CPM equal to $10. So what we end up doing is, we would end up choosing the ad that has the higher expected CPM. That's really how the auctioning goes. Yes.
You speak of the click-through rate of a particular ad. Is that within the particular context of these people of this search or globally?
Right. So the question is the click is the click-through rate, is that for a given specific keyword? The answer is yes. And in fact, I'll be talking, there are a few more parameterizations. In a few cases, the click-through rate on a given ad from a certain country would be different than click-through rate on the same criteria from another country, or time of day of another metric as well. So the number of dimensions that you would use for using historical click-through rates and predicting how CTR is changing over time.
One of the key dimensions where the ad is, I mean, the calculation that you described is a simplification of the question.
So I made the point that I'm sort of like simplifying a whole bunch of things that I'm talking about. I'll add a few more dimensions in a few slides. For example, position is key. You're influencing how much an ad is going to be clicked on by placing it at the very top spot, because people's eyes tend to be the top right-hand corner. And so there are a number of things you need to do to fix that. Yeah?
Did they click to wait for an ad before you started showing?
Great question. Yeah, briefly talk about some of the challenges over there. But yeah, that's one of the problems that we need to worry about.
Yeah, I think
there's
competition with each other. Are you in competition with Google?
The question is, the advertisers are in competition with each other. Are they in competition with Google? So, the question is, how much do we pay? How much do we get out of this auction? So, this slide would hopefully answer your question. The 40 cents that the one company wanted to pay and 20 cents the other company wanted to pay are the true value of how much they perceive that split. And it's depending on how much conversion they end up getting in terms of once they click on an ad, they end up buying the service from their own heart. So they've reflected that into their CPC that is made up. But you notice that the effective CPM we got on one of the ads, when you go back, was $8, and an effective CPM on the other ad was $10. But, and so because of that, we decided that number one was actually going to be higher ranked than the second one. But if the top placed ad had ended up bidding only $8.05, they would have still won the auction, right? Because they don't need to have paid $10 worth of effective CPM to Google. So this is sort of a problem. So what we end up doing is we act as if they did only charge a little bit more. So what we end up asking the advertiser to pay is only $16 per click, not 20 cents per click. So effectively, this is what is called as a second price auction, and this is one of many ways to do an auction. So in terms of whether this is whether Google is an adversary in this case or not, what we want to do is we want to build up an efficient auctioning system where the advertiser bids the true value, and the system acts in the best interest of the advertiser from a cost that they pay standpoint. Click-through rate, we still want to make sure that the user is sort of dominated in that case. But the amount of money that the advertiser pays for us, it's in our interest to make sure that in the longer term, they are only giving us accurate data about how much they need to bid. Then there's no competition. Let's say that you have a very exotic product you want to sell. Let's say you only want to target green pencils that have a Mickey Mouse logo on it. That could be the company that you have. So in that case, if there's no one else bidding for that particular slot, then you end up paying the minimum, which is only 5 cents, which is a great way to sort of get your ad onto Google. And given that there's enough inventory of keywords coming to Google, it just keeps the long tail keeps going. And again, just to summarize the point I was making earlier, the quality of the ad is still very paramount, because users will not be happy if they start seeing very, very broad ads. So we want to make sure that is reflected in how we show the ad. And so in a number of cases, if you notice that the click-through rate is below a certain threshold, you will stop showing the ad, independent of how much the advertiser is going to pay. And also, the amount of money that the advertiser is paying is as close to how much the real value that is the bid. Actually, it's going to be lower than how much the real value is in bid. Let's go in just a little bit into auction theory. Any questions before we get to this? So, the flavor of what I just talked about is going to be more obvious if you look at how the dynamics sort of work out. So, number of auctions that you had in the past. The English version was the going in and going and gone, where you start at a certain minimum price, and then you have multiple bidders who start saying, okay, I'm going to bid an extra $10 on that item. And it keeps going on until there's no more bidders working on that auction. Dutch had a different way of doing things. They kept dropping the price until someone fights. So you started a certain high value, and you keep lowering the overall price until someone bids. Again, a lot of these things assume that it's a uniform price auction. The value of the good that you're bidding on is roughly the same by everybody. If you're buying an artwork, then this is pretty makes sense, because the bidding patterns and how people the actual way in which people bid differs on their perceived value, which is quite different. So in all these cases, we're assuming that the value is roughly the same for all the people bidding for that product. First price seed is typical in silent auctions. You have a piece of artwork, and rather than going through the charade of having multiple people raising their titles, you ask them to write the amount of money they're willing to pay into a seed funnel, and you pick the best price for the good. The problem with a lot of these things is what is commonly called the winner's curse. So, speaking about the uniform price auction, where everyone should really evaluate the commodity in a similar way. If you take the number of bidders, the average that the group is willing to bid is probably closest to the real value of that commodity, right? So the problem is that the winner is clearly winning by paying a lot more than the average. So this is kind of a problem, because a few years back, a number of oil companies used to bid for drilling rights in pick a new oil field that comes online, and the average bid might be $10 million, and which is probably reflective of what the true value is. But a lot of them ended up paying, they wanted the oil field, so they ended up paying $10 million. So people got smarter quickly, and they realized that they were overbidding. So they started lowering their bids, and this is commonly called bid shading. And this complicates how the advertiser has to decide how to select a bid. So in all these cases, we have a problem. If we build a product which people don't know how to use, in terms of not being able to figure out they need to bid 30 cents for a certain commodity, then we have a problem. So we don't want to get into that game. This has been studied a lot in economics. So weekly auction is a pretty well-known auction. And the model here is that the second price seed, so you have a number of blind auctions that are going on effectively. And what you end up doing is you end up taking the second-highest bid as what the demand ends up paying. And it proved that it has a simple bidding strategy, just bid your true value, and it all sort of works out. And he won the Nobel Prize for this observation. So realize that a few slides back, I essentially just talked about this. When you have the $8 ECPM and the $10 ECPM, we end up charging the advertiser, the winning advertiser, only the second ECPM rather than the first ECPM. So this is partly how we get past some of the bidding problems.
You're not paying the second highest bid, you're paying the second highest bid weighted by Strickler, which is
true. So the question is, it's not exactly the victory option, but it's but what we do in the AdWords backend is similar to what this tool does, and it handles a whole bunch of cases where you can even start arguing as to whether we have given a certain criteria where you have two different industries bidding on the same criteria, like for example skydiving for insurance or skydiving for some other entity. Do they really have the true value or not? So we've done a number of simplifications to the decree concept to achieve better properties. We can explore that, but it's probably a really complicated for this audience. Alright? But that's the high-level concept of how the second price bid is reflective of it is a reasonable proxy for how to get the advertisers to give the true value or close to the true value without getting into questions about whether they are going to be part of the they're going to have winner scores or not. So I'm going to start talking about the systems that power the ads backend, so now that we know roughly how the auctioning process works. One of the questions that came up is, how do you predict the CTR? We do not know, in our calculation to compute the effective CPM, the CPC is something that we just talked about. How much we charge to the advertiser is roughly just what the previous bid was. But another complex problem over here is, what is the CTR that you think a given criteria creative, which is the ad, actually has, so that you can end up maximizing the CPM. If the actual CTR prediction is off, then the auctioning parameters get turned into zero as well. And it's much more complicated than just predicting the CTR of a given ad, because it depends on a country, depends on the actual query, depends on time of day. Lots of different dimensions. So one of the problems that we have constantly is, how do you update the model? So one way computationally you can think of how we can do this is to look at historical data. So imagine having a very, very fast system that takes into account how the ads for a given advertiser are performing, or for a given concept are performing, and reflect the behavior of what the users are doing very quickly through a very, very fast system, and model based on what has happened historically, and predict the future, that the likely CTR for the certain constant interval is 2% for this particular creator. So the number of challenges are going into building a system like that from a systems building standpoint as well as from a prediction standpoint, so we invest a lot of work on that. And also, how do you estimate the CTR for a not yet shown ad? It's another hard problem, because if you have an ad that comes in that has never been shown before, then what do you expect as a CTR? So a number of possible solutions. One is you can go with the base CTR, and given a certain criteria, the query, say that this on average is about 3%, and on average like 0.5%. And start with an initial model and refine it quickly. Or you could sort of say that the click rate on a given country is 1% because people don't like to click on ads. Or during the day, people don't like to click on ads because they have to work. So take a whole bunch of dimensions like that, and you essentially you could model an initial approximation, and then you can refine the predictions for that. The interesting part is that every single one of these things is purely experimental. You have an initial idea as to what is a good way of estimating some of these numbers, and as you refine these numbers, the amount of money we end up making, or the end user quality, or the amount of money the advertiser ends up spending, all changes quite dramatically. This is why this is a cool system. Try it out, and see what happens, and then change your behavior and change the algorithm based on different estimation techniques. The other part of the system is that the advertisers are spending a lot of money in the system, so they want to know what is going on very, very quickly. Now think about how search works. Search is much less dynamic in that you can crawl the web for, I don't know, like a number of weeks, months, and pre-compute all the indices you want to, and you want to push it to multiple data centers in different countries, different geographical areas, so the end user query is a lot faster. Similarly, in the case of ads, we would want to necessarily be close to where the search queries are coming from, so we can serve our ads very quickly as well. So now you have a number of data centers, a number of machines across lots of geographical areas. And now you want to solve the problem of how do I count my clicks, how do I compute my impressions in a global distributed fashion so that I can accurately predict how the auction is going to play out. So these are some of the challenges we have to solve, which are much more complex because the dynamic nature and the real-time nature of the ads are not the data needs to process. Also, they would like to know how the advertisers would like to know how are my advertisements performing in a given country or in a given time of day. So computing all that is hard because you cannot really use traditional databases to solve the number of reads and writes we need to process. We've looked at commercial databases and they don't scale for the number of reads and writes that we have to have to process. Or if they scale, then they are way too expensive. So one of the decisions we made early on was to use MySQL. It's free, so you can't argue with the price. And it also is, you have the code to work with. So you can go and modify the code to do special things for you. You can change the backend storage if you wanted to. You can change the MySQL parser if you wanted to, or the query engine if you wanted to. So what we do is we take all the customers that we have and we shard or we partition all our customers into several different database servers. And also we clone them to make sure that we have enough reliability and we have enough enough throughput. So we want to make sure the advertisers can come in and change their campaigns very quickly. We want to make sure that we are serving all the ads that we serve very, very quickly so that the end user is not suffering for that. So this model of having partitioned data across multiple databases and replicating them like crazy is how the system has evolved. Along the way, we had to build up our own languages because we wanted to make sure that from an engineering standpoint, we could modify the schema, we could modify how we render the content on the front-end servers, blah, 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 so that we could... So we had to invent a new language along the way. So this is just another flavor of things that we have to do. Building large systems, building up new languages, building up how we modify the schema, and all these sort of are core components of how we end up scaling the app. Especially.
Yeah, to manage
a cluster? Right, so there's another talk that Michael is going to give a little bit of. Michael is there. Yeah. So we have built up a number of other parts of our stack this is how we run all our applications. We have a number of machine management mechanisms. We have a number of file copying mechanisms. We have our own distributed file system. We have a number of systems we've built up for the reuse, for some of the backups, for some of the recovery, the snapshotting, transactions that also apply in how we do the ad system. But ads is different, again, from the search system, in that there the data is all very static, relatively, and there is much more dynamic. So the solutions that we have are different. That's what I want to get across to this part of the talk. So I'm going to switch to contextually targeted ads. So until now, the problem has been interesting in that it's, you have a query that comes into Google, green balls, and you want to show ads related to that particular keyword. And it's a lookup. You go look it up, and then you figure out from the auction which is the best ad to show given a number of ads that you want to work with, and you have a whole bunch of systems that you have built up that figure out how to predict CTR, how to move the data very, very quickly across multiple data centers, and so on. This problem has the same flavor of issues, but it's quite different. Here, we do not have a query. So we launched the AdSense product about a few years back. And the goal here was, how do we show contextually related ads to any page on the web? So if the page is about cheese.com, then you want to show ads about cheese. The page is about a digital camera, then you want to show ads about Nikon D70 and the Canon as well as other generic digital cameras. So this is a different problem because there's no keyword that you can use to figure out what ads to show. So in this case, we have cheese, we have some recipes, we have boost rank on the techniques, and we have some English cheddar and a number of other things. So all of this is, you must have seen, how many of you have seen these ads by Google on all kinds of pages? So a number of you. So here the problem is, we do not know what to show on the page. So it's a contextual targeting problem, given some content. AdSense for content is the same, the product that we're talking about, the same as the AdWords, in that we're still using the AdWords advertisers. We've built up a large number of AdWords advertisers that come in and said, we want to show ads on digital cameras, or we want to show ads on green pencils. It's still the same set of advertisers. Ranking is still done based on an expected CPM. And the second price auction, all the things we talked about in terms of how the auctioning works, still works the same way. But the problem that is different here is it's not a simple lookup. Here, it's not a matter of getting a query from Google.com and going and looking up a deal and saying, okay, these are the candidates ads that you would likely want to show on the screen. Here, the publisher, this could be Slashdot, and they could have a new article about digital camera. So the publisher gives us inventory, and based on the target URL, which is slash.org/camera0015.html, we have a show, we have to quickly crawl the page, figure out what the page is about, and then show ads that are most relevant to that page. And here, we share the revenue with the publisher. In case of Google.com, it's our property, so we keep the money. Here, the publisher is doing a lot of work by getting an inventory on their side. So we want to make sure that we share the revenue with them. And also, we have a lot more new formats and new media types. For example, we have images, we have flash ads, because that's what the publishers want. So this is the billion-dollar JavaScript snippet. This is what the publishers put on their site. It's a very simple bit of JavaScript. So they specify the width of the ad. In this case, it's 728. And 728 by 90 is considered to be a simple, very specific creator size. And then they can say that I want a text image. And all they do is they just source in this the JavaScript, which is hosted on GoogleCitycation.com. Yeah.
So one of the things that I read is the incentives have changed. So the publisher wants people to click on that because they make some money alongside you. And there's a problem with click-flop. And the
considering that you track the IP addresses, so you can see if all of the sites come from that prison on computer. What I'm wondering about is what if somebody created a Google virus, which is to give the publishers a tool that allows them to cycle a large number of IP addresses through the click on their site. Would that be very damaging to Google?
The question is, how do we handle the fraud in the AdSense situation? Because the incentives are aligned to the publisher to try to spoof Google as much as possible, and specifically, can we go through a bunch of IP addresses to spoof the way in which we handle click fraud? The way in which we handle click fraud, and this is clearly an important area for us, so we've been working on these areas for a number of years now. We use, again, a variety of signals on figuring out how much are we paying to the publisher. And how we end up, how much we pay to them is it depends on the clicks in one of the dimensions. But also we look at other ways which we can figure out if they are spoofing us or not. We terminate publishers very quickly for doing something and we refund money back to the advertisers. It's a huge pipeline that goes along with handling the stuff. But I can't tell you exactly what all the different signals because this is pretty surprising. But yeah, clearly, it's, you know, we worry about it a lot, and we fix it up.
How can they check whether they're
getting the right So the question is, how do advertisers know that they're getting the right kind of traffic? So they clearly know what clicks they are getting onto their site, because if the click on an ad, it ends up going, the user ends up going to the advertiser's landing page. So that's one part of the equation. We also launched a conversion tracking product a few years back, and it's a simple idea. So what you want to do is, once the user gets to the landing page, they may end up doing a whole bunch of other things on their site, and then end up going to a checkout page, or through an email fill-up form. So what hunters have done is, they've opted into this specific way of tracking, whereby when a user ends up going to the final conversion page, we end up getting back a one-by-one pixel, which sends a cookie along, whereby we can track that this user who clicked on the ad also ends up converting on your site. That's information that we offer to the advertiser as well.
So the advertiser can tell on what contract to take through the page.
Yeah, so the advertiser, so the question is, how does the advertiser track the value of the given click through the entire life cycle? There's a number of things that the advertisers have done, because you know, they're clearly making, they want to have more leads and they think of this as a big deal to track. So they do a number of things. For example, on the conversion page, which is their final checkout page or their email fill-up page, they do tell us back that the value, think of it as a random string. They tell us the value of this conversion is $25, or the value of this conversion was a email sign up. And they track the information again in aggregate and give it back to the same thing. You got 25 clicks and you got 13 impressions, the 13 conversions on the final page that you don't know. They can track it. That's another way in which we can address quick ones, because they have different tools that they can talk to looking at the value of the click. So I showed this billion-dollar JavaScript snippet. This is all over the web, and what it does is pretty straightforward. It tries to figure out the number of parameters that it automatically gets filled in, and we end up showing an ad on essentially an iframe. So imagine on the top of the page, there's an iframe request that points to our backend server, and we get along the way the document.url or the document.referrer, which tells us what the page is, the URL of the page, or the referring URL of the page. And based on that, we can either go quickly crawl, or in a number of cases, we also have the google.com crawler, which may have already crawled the page, so we just go quickly look it up, and then we go and figure out what the page is about. Now, the second part is pretty interesting. In terms of how do we figure out what the page is about, I'll get to those slides. In the publisher network, we have launched a number of different kinds of number of different kinds of ad formats. So image ads, audio ads, click-to-call ads. So here is actually a case where we have a little telephonic icon, and we click on that, and the user can end up calling the advertiser. So this is one of the things that we launched as part of the department office across the street. And video ads. So number of ways that we can show advertisements on a publisher page that is, again, contextually relevant to the page, and gives the advertiser different options through which they can decide what they want to expose to the user. We talked about different models. In the AdWords case, we went from a CPM model, the cost per impression model, to a cost per click model over time. But in the AdSense network, the large number of publishers who show these ads, they prefer to decide how they want to get paid. In the case of paper impressions, they don't take any risk. They just get paid whenever we sell a 1,000 impressions. The cost per click model is there's more sort of hands they have. They have more of an incentive to take a bit more risk, but the reward can be higher as well. So there's some interesting challenges like that too. So in terms of we talked about, we know what the pages have based on the document or URL, and we have the actual content of the page. So now, how do we figure out automatically that the page is about cheese or about the chicanos? So we need to understand what the page is about, and also define the best matching ads. And how do you even define a best match? Because in the case of cheese, there are different ads you could have shown. You could have shown an ad about cheese recipes, or about English cheddar cheese, or losing 20 pounds in 30 days. Also, there are some restrictions. There are some business restrictions that you don't want to show a competitor's ad. If it's a site that is selling DSL services, then you don't want to show that for another service provider. And this is all done very, very, very much. A lot of times in a given day. So all this has to happen within a few milliseconds, because the end user is not going to wait for us to choose the best ad. So when a request comes in, an iframe request comes in, you've got to figure out within some tens of milliseconds what the page is about and show the ad back to you. This is where all the challenges come in. In AdWords, I talked about how we use MySQL databases to partition our data. AdSense, on the other hand, is actually slightly more, it's less database-y. It's more about using a lot of the Google infrastructure that Michael will be talking about. I'm going to find Michael here. So Michael will be talking about it in about an hour. It's a lot of reusing of the stack in terms of, we want to take a lot of data about the pages, and about how queries get to pages, and the number of other signals, and figure out what are the key concepts behind those pages. So we use our usual classic GFS, we use our Google file system, and a number of the partitioning mechanisms we built up to analyze large amounts of data pretty quickly. But I'm not going to spend too much time on that. So how does the analysis of a page work? So the classic observation that people have is that if you have a lot more sort of computational power, you can solve very hard problems. So the problem that we are solving is actually different. It's more about the data. If there is a lot more data that we have, either through search queries or through web pages, then our claim is that you can actually solve very hard problems. And this is one of the key insights into how AdSense works. Here's an example. How do you define similarity between Kofi Annan and the UN Secretary General? Clearly, they're the same person. But from a classic PF IDF perspective, the metric, the cosine between the two is zero, because there's no matching between the two. So just to sort of quickly go over PF IDF, PF is the frequency of the term in a given document query. So just counting up the number of terms in our IDF is trying to, the intuition behind this is that if a word is too popular, then pretty much just discard it. This is what the IDF, it's the inverse document frequency. This is term frequency, this is inverse document frequency. PF IDF is just, you know, the cosine between PF and the IDF. So I think the next slide is a an example. To a human, most of these things are exactly the same. AI, artificial intelligence, Eric Schmidt, Google CEO, Larry Page, Google founder. But the classic TF-IDF mechanism will say that the overlap between these two is zero, because they look nothing like each other. But this is essentially the problem we need to solve in AdSense, because the pages themselves may not necessarily have all the terms that the advertiser is talking about. They may have different terms, they may have related terms, they may be talking about Canon D70, but may not use the word digital cameras in any of the given text. But do you want to show an ad that has something to do with Nikon's? Probably. So this is part of the motivation behind how do you start looking at combining, how do you start looking at overlap between different textual elements? And the inverse also applies. Larry Page, web page have nothing to do with each other. So the metric that you want to use to compute the similarity between two pieces of text should split off the possibilities so that the ones that are closely related should be greater than some threshold, and the ones that have nothing to do with each other should be below some threshold. Conceptual. What we do is this is one way of coming up with a metric, and there are a number of other ways. I'm just going to walk through a simple example of how we could solve the AdSense query overlap problem. We have to use a lot more contextual meaning. That's really what we need to do. So what we do is we want to take the if given a short text snippet, we want to make sure that we can expand it to other related concepts as well. So this is sort of similar to how query expansion works in IR. So let's walk through a way in which we can do this. So let X and Y be two short text snippets. And we want to define a function that measures the semantic similarity between X and Y. One approach for doing this is to define the query expansion as follows. Take X and send that as a query to, say, a search engine like Google, and get back a whole bunch of documents. So now the word artificial intelligence would have been the key query. Send it off to Google, and it comes back with, say, 20 results. You can take each of those documents as your result set, and you can start defining the QE of X to be the average of all the vectors. So essentially, for every TF-ID vector that you have for a given result document, you can say that my query expansion of X, which is the keyword that I sent out, is essentially the average of all the TF-ID vectors across all the documents. And you can define the similarity between X and Y, the word to be the two text snippets that you want to find the similarity between. Qof.qofy. Here's the example again that we talked about a little while back. So the cosine metric that we talked about, the TF-IDF measure, clearly has a value of zero for all the different cases. And in this version of, in this implementation of the query expansion, the numbers look a lot more reasonable. So Larry Page has f of x, y of 0.123. I'm actually skipping over a bunch of details, but the point is that with that metric, you can have enough of a spread between the ones that are close to you and the ones that are far away from you. And clearly, there are a number of other ways in which you can do this. The better job you do of spreading out these things and making the textual snippets be similar or dissimilar, the better ads we end up showing to the user. So this is what we keep thinking about, how to improve the different metrics, how do we keep building up new metrics, and also how do we pre-compute as much as we can so that when a request comes in from an end user, it's very, very fast. It has to be done within a few tens of milliseconds. The inverse problem, as I was talking about earlier, is how do you sort of handle different contexts for the same word Java. So Java Indonesia, clearly again, the cosines are meaningless in this case, but you can see that there's, based on the algorithm that I showed in the previous slide, there's a pretty good sort of spread between where the scores end up lying. Thank you. So a bunch of people do this. Right, so my last slide is about the curtain office that we have across the water. We've launched a bunch of things. A number of them have been in ads, some of them have been in search quality and other areas as well. So we've had a number of projects on AdWords optimization that have added a lot of money to the company. Simple ideas that where you improve the metric that you use, or simple ideas that end up speeding up some computation, end up adding a huge amount of leverage to the company. AdSense quality is another area. Analytics, click-to-call ads, where you click on a live one, we end up having people talk to each other. We have a number of things in search, where we have indexing, sitemaps, webmaster console, number of consumer products. We have a lot of work going on Google Maps, Google Video, Google Back. So a number of things are happening in the Seattle curtain operation. So if you have any questions, you can find me, or I'll take any more.
You were talking about how the auction possible the dynamics of things very dynamic. Certainly, in terms of click-through rate, it has changed all the time. But can advertisers change their bid on a very frequent
basis? So the question is, do advertisers end up changing their bids on a regular basis? Yes, they do. Which is why we need to have a very dynamic system that reflects all the changes they do, not just from a change the bid standpoint, but they end up changing the creative that they want to show. They want to end up changing the list of keywords on which they want to show their.
The person, sits and, every day, the ad guy at the store, the owner does it, whatever. But I'm talking, are there advertisers that have, does the advertiser get feedback on how often they missed an auction, stuff like that? And if so, do they have an API or something to allow them to respond or something like that to change things or more?
Right. So we certainly have an API, and a number of companies use that to change. We have this feedback loop whereby we tell them how many auctions they win, how many clicks they get. Based on that, how much money they want to spend, they want to certainly define how they play with the system. So that happens a lot. So that's why building a truly dynamic system that handles to the scale is really a bit complexity.
Thank you very much.